You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In a front-page review in the Sunday New York Times book section, Colson Whitehead called George Saunders' first novel, Lincoln in the Bardo, a luminous feat of generosity and humanism. It's told through a combination of elements found in historical fiction, the supernatural, and magical realism. Abraham Lincoln and his fellow Americans are beginning to realize in 1862 that the end of the Civil War is nowhere in sight, and meanwhile, Willie, the president's beloved 11-year-old son, has just died. It's a vulnerable moment in Lincoln's life, a moment in which everything around him seems to be falling apart. The book, narrated for the most part by ghosts, is published by Random House, and I'm very pleased it has brought George Saunders back to our show. Welcome back.
It's great to be here.
And in the past, we've only talked about short stories. This is nothing like a short story.
It is not. It is not. I had always, I think we've talked about the fact that I was very proud to not be a novelist, and this story got under my skin about 20 years ago, and finally in 2012, I just thought, all right, I'll try it, you know, and then it just kind of organically grew.
When you say this story, the story of Abraham Lincoln and the loss of his 11-year-old son, yeah. Willie, or this whole Buddhist concept of the bardo?
No, it was really small. It was just one of those things you dream of happening as a writer. We were in D.C. in the 90s, and my wife's cousin just pointed out the crypt where Willie had been briefly buried, and she just offhand...
And he was then moved.
That's right, with Lincoln in the train, and she just sort of... offhandedly said, oh yeah, and did you know that newspapers at the time reported that Lincoln was so grief-stricken he entered the crypt and had some kind of interaction with the body? And that just kind of lit up my mind with this combination of the Pieta and the Lincoln Memorial. But at that time, I thought, oh, I can't do that. It's not in my wheelhouse, you know. I have a very narrow ledge of talent, and that wasn't going to be accessible from there. So I just let it go for 20 years, but it kept coming back, you know.
Well, this wouldn't also lend itself to linked short stories.
No, and also just how do you get into it? Because he's alone in there, so who's going to narrate this, you know?
And much of the novel takes place at the cemetery where Willie was originally buried. The spirits who live in the cemetery exist in this world you refer to as the Bardo. The Bardo is a kind of like a Buddhist version of limbo, Christian concept of limbo.
Right. The difference is that, you know, I was raised Catholic, and my version of purgatory was it was kind of not negotiable. You know, you messed up, you went there, and you sat on a hard bench until the end of days. My version of the Bardo, it's not strictly, you know, in keeping with the canonical text, but my version of it is... it's a little more transactional. You know, you stay there because something didn't go right for you in this life, and you're kind of a prisoner of your, the discontents that you accumulate in this life, or the regrets, or that kind of thing.
So how does a ghost get out of the Bardo?
Well, in my particular one, you actually come to grips with the fact that you're dead. They're all kind of, it's almost like a graveyard of alcoholics because they're all in denial. You know, they don't want to say the word dead. They don't want to admit to that, and if they can be sort of convinced that that's the case. But on a second level, it's kind of about, I guess in life you accumulate these grievances or these desires that aren't satisfied. These particular people have to kind of go, well, that's how it is, and it's time for me to move on.
But Willie's an 11-year-old kid, and he doesn't have all that much of a checkered past. Mm. Why is he stuck in the Bardo?
My sense was he's stuck there just out of that love for his parents, basically, especially his father, and his disbelief that this could have happened to him. So he's not supposed to, in the world of the book, he's not supposed to linger. But it's just that, you know, I imagine if I keeled over right now, I'd be thinking, I can't die, I'm on Leonard Lopate. You know, so you have that sense of we can't.
People have died on the show.
Well, metaphorically. But, you know, you have that feeling that your mind is so powerful and it's in continuous habits. And so I love the idea that if it happened, you would be saying, wait a minute, not me, not now, you know.
Didn't you first try to write this as a play?
I did. I had about a 10-year misadventure with it. And at one point in my yearly end-of-year assessment, I wrote across the top, Runaway, don't try it. You know?
On the other hand, you see the play in this novel.
Yes. And you know what's really funny is I have the same problem. If I ever say I'm going to write a poem, I write a poem, and it's bad news. So when I thought of myself as writing a play, it was just sort of wooden. And when I gave myself permission to say, no, it's actually prose, what you always do, then it was more natural.
So each subchapter, which reads like a scene from a play, is told through the weaving of statements or monologues, both fiction, but you also use nonfiction.
That's right. At some point, you know, the ghost is sort of like the ontological equivalent of a dream sequence. And I had a writing teacher once tell me that you're allowed three dream sequences in your career.
You know, so you have three ghosts.
Don't blow them. Yeah. So as the ghost accumulated, I started to think I need some kind of historical spine. And I knew a lot of these really moving backstories about Willie's death and so on. So I kind of struggle with how to get those in there. And you think, well, maybe we'll have a grave digger or something, you know. But in the end, I just sort of asked myself, how do you know those stories? And the truth is, I just read a bunch of history books. So I decided to just sample them. I spent a long time typing up big blocks of text and then cutting them up with scissors and arranging them on the floor and trying to make a standalone novelistic chapters out of these things.
And you wound up with Hans Volman, Roger Bevans III, and Reverend Everly Thomas. Although there are 166 voices in this novel.
Yeah.
At least that's what I've read. I didn't count everyone.
Well, the only reason I know that is because we took on this ambitious audiobook project, and there's a producer named Kelly Gilday who said, why don't we try to do a different voice for every monologue? And then she had a spreadsheet, and it was 166, and then she went out and got them, you know.
So, you see, you wound up with some pretty famous people reading along with you. You did one of them. Many times they asked the author to read the whole text for the audiobook.
Well, they did, and I had the thought of me reading this long book in this South Side of Chicago accent, and I just thought, no, I can't. So that's when the idea came up. But Nick Offerman is on, and David Sedaris. They do the two other main parts, and then just this all-star team of great actors, and then a sub-all-star team of sort of legendary audiobook readers, and then another all-star team of my mom, my dad, my sister, my wife, my kids, and my two high school teachers. And it was hard to get 166.
Now, your primary narrators are all males. Would there have been women in the cemetery?
Yeah, there are women. My thought was that this is a little bit of a stretch, but in that time, if you were a dead dude, you would tend to cluster with other dead dudes as opposed to, you know. Also, it made a little bit of a complication if there was that kind of mixing. But there are a lot of women who step in and have a kind of monologues and bits.
And in his review of the book, Thomas Mallon describes this as a series of snippets labeled with the identity of their speakers, almost as if the gravestones in this particular theme park have a push-button audio function for visitors.
I love that. I think somebody better do that.
Many of the spirits at the Bardo have been there for a long time. But there's something about Willie and his visits from his father, President Lincoln, that causes some stir. And it's not that that Lincoln is the president. What's so intriguing about their relationship with the other ghosts?
Mm. Well, one of the things that developed in the writing was that these dead people they felt a little like second-class citizens. You know, they were aware that they weren't what they used to be. They couldn't be active. They had a limited sensory range. So It turns out that living people are kind of like celebrity sightings to them, you know. So not only does a living person come in the middle of the night, which is unprecedented, but then he goes and actually has physical contact with his son. And this kind of activates them, like, to think, well, maybe we're not quite as useless as we thought we were. So it creates this kind of stir of instability in the community.
Well, after Lincoln mourns by holding Willie's dead body, many of the other ghosts believe that Willie will rise from the dead to live again, treating him like a Jesus-like figure.
Yeah.
Now, Buddhism is the gives us the concept of the Bardo, Tibetan Buddhism, but there's kind of a general religious undertone throughout this narrative.
Yeah, well, one of the things that I was reading some text in Tibetan Buddhism, and one of the ideas is that when you die, your way of thinking gets supersized. The damping mechanism that was your body is gone. So whatever your thought habits are, whatever your symbolic language is, gets supersized. So if you're a Catholic, you see, you know, Jesus and Mary and so on. If you're a Buddhist, you see Buddhist gods. And so that was kind of an exciting thought that everyone's going to be religious in their own flavor. Even if you're not religious, you're going to see something. Maybe you'll see the Kardashians or something.
Please, not the Kardashians. Do you see similarities between Buddhism and President Lincoln's character? For the most part, his devotion to Willie in America is pretty selfless.
Yeah. What I saw in him, just from reading a bunch, was that he had what I think is kind of a spiritual quality of being able to look at what was actually happening in front of him at the moment and somewhat get free of his idea of what was happening. So when he got into some of these really tricky parts of the Civil War, you could see him sort of taking a deep breath and trying to actually look at what was occurring instead of what he wished was occurring. You know.
I'm speaking with George Saunders, whose latest book is... How many books have you published so far?
Nine, eight,
and 12? And this is the first novel.
It's the first novel.
It's called Lincoln in the Bardo. There are slaves in the Bardo, and they play a significant role in the story.
They do, yeah. The idea, I think my research indicated that they couldn't have been buried in Oak Hill at that time, so I have them in a kind of a common grave off to the side, and at one pivotal moment they come over into the fence, over the fence, and... then they sort of basically interact with Lincoln in these different ways. And I mean, I kind of feel like if you're writing a book about the Civil War, you have to have that presence, you know.
When you were on the show in 2007, you said that you'd given up on separating the personal from the political, that it's not possible. How do you see this story as both personal and political? Mm.
Well, I finished it before the Trump phenomenon happened, and I went right from this to cover the Trump campaign for the New Yorker. So I think what I felt after I finished this book was this kind of almost corny sense of the country coming alive again. Like, oh, this is actually a thing that's in progress that we've never perfected, but it's kind of a beautiful idea. It's going to get off the road from now and then. And so I felt kind of maybe soppily patriotic afterwards, you know.
And then in an interview with Poets and Writers, you said that you're trying to make your work more like you.
Yeah.
Don't fiction writers always complain when people ask how much of you is in this?
Well, I think what I'm trying to do is, before I, you know, die, is to try to do some kind of credit to the way it actually feels, which is to take all the beauty that we know and the love and the gratitude and all that stuff, look at that, then look at the downside, you know, the evil in the human heart and the confusion and all that, and then just let those two things resonate against each other, almost without preferring or privileging one over the other, but just say, yeah, this is the way it is. And for me, that's a race because I understand the evil better. To write something about the blessings in your life or the beauty in the human spirit, it actually takes more chops, I think. It's harder. So I'm racing to try to get those chops in place so I can put that model in.
We're more in touch with our negative side than our positive side?
I think so. And also, you know, that saying, happiness writes white. And I think that is true. There's something about dysfunction that is jangly on the page, and somebody with a lower level of skill can credit it. When you get up into the realm of, you know, a long marriage or a long friendship or your relationship with your kids, it takes a real precision to get that right, I think, and do it justice.
Yeah. There aren't too many novels where nothing really terrible happens that are successful.
Right.
I think of the Macioka sisters, perhaps one or two others. But.
Yeah. Or, you know, in some Chekhov, there's a way in which it doesn't go horribly wrong, except you see the little inflections, the small, sad inflections.
We mentioned the audiobook, but haven't you made a virtual reality film for Lincoln in the Bardo?
A wonderful...
This is in conjunction with the New York Times?
Yes, a wonderful young director named Graham Sack made it, and I just consulted lightly with him, but it's a really beautiful 12-minute crazy dream that I experienced a couple weeks ago. It's really something.
And you also have a series coming out on Amazon TV based on a short story that you wrote, C.O., and a TV project with Ben Stiller based on Civil War Land in Bad Decline.
We're working on it.
Now, Civil War Land in Bad Decline, many people, I'm sure, are assuming, was what led you to think about Lincoln and all of this. But you've said that's not the case?
No, I think I haven't heard writers talk about this much, but I know there are four or five little ideas that are just interesting to me, and that period, for some reason, is red hot in my mind. Ever since I was a little kid, the Civil War was just interesting. Everything from the photographs and to see the battlefields. So I think you kind of go back and again to these hot spots, not really sure why. And there isn't, I mean, you can dress it up in thematics, but for me, it's just something about that period is fascinating.
You said all of these things are in development. Mm. So this book began as a play, and now you're doing screenwriting as well.
I hope I am. We'll see if I am or not.
But that's taking you away from your comfort zone, which is writing short stories. Do you see one as feeding the other?
Yes. You know, I joke, but I don't. My talent, I discovered in my 30s, is really thin. I'm not... You know, so that means that I'll go as deep as I can with fiction, and then if I go sideways by doing a nonfiction or a screenplay or anything, somehow the well refills, and I can come back at that narrow ledge from a different angle.
And in an interview for the Book Review podcast, you said that you write to challenge yourself to learn.
Yeah.
So what did you learn in this process? Anything surprising?
Well, I'll tell you. It's something like this. To be in a novel for 4 years, you find out that there's a part of your mind that is very strange and spacious, and it actually thrives on intuitive choices and ambiguity and all these kind of vaguely soft virtues. And then to come out of that and cover the Trump campaign was interesting because there you see a different kind of mind working, you know, a more kind of social media mind. So I was just kind of... feel like doubling down on art as a really important tool for social change and for even resistance.
Now, this book is probably the most difficult thing you've ever written to talk about in an interview.
It is.
How would you like listeners to understand what you're trying to do here?
Well, my feeling about it from the beginning was I want the reader to go into this book, maybe struggle a bit at first because it's not easy to get into. And then I just want it to be a visceral experience that's very moving. And I think the formal stuff will explain itself as you read. And ultimately, I just wanted to write about this contradiction that, you know, we seem to be put into this world to love each other, and we all do that pretty naturally. You know, when things are really tough, we turn to that. You know, who do I love? What do I value? And that's beautiful. Then, meanwhile, up the track is coming this train labeled death. You know, I'm coming for you. So how do you make a functional, positive life out of that? Now, what I do is deny the death. Now, it's for everybody else. But it seems to me that there's a possibility of making life more full by trying to reconcile. I mean, we're all trying to do it every day. So for me, that ultimately is what the book is about. Lincoln, at this moment of incredible stress, where the weight of the world and the fate of all these people is on his shoulders, and this crushing blow comes, and he's got to try to figure out how to keep going.
And now that you've written a novel, and not a brief novel, but one over 300 pages, do you feel comfortable with the form?
It's a pretty weird novel. I think it's a novel, but somebody described a novel as, you know...
a lot of fiction here, even if you do use some...
I feel
some
comfortable
non-fictional
with it.
Techniques.
Yeah, I feel comfortable that, you know, I think a story has a DNA, and if you listen to it, it will tell you how long it wants to be. So I feel pretty comfortable that I can make that call.
Now you're back to short stories?
Yeah, back to stories. And if one of those wants to get ambitious, I'm happy to have it.
Thank you so much for coming by to talk about this one, Lincoln in the Bardo. It is published by Random House, George Saunders' first novel, but I suspect not his last.